Tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Very sweet to hear everyone chant that again. So, can you hear me okay in the back? All right. So I wanted to speak a little bit tonight about the four stages of awakening. And Venerable Ananya will speak a bit more tomorrow about the path and fruit, going into more detail, but I just kind of wanted to bring it in. And also, before I start, just to acknowledge the potency in this room. There's a sense of potency from all of our practice together, and from the sila that we're keeping, and from listening to the Dharma and practicing. It's just like, it feels quite a rich field, and I'm aware of what a precious thing this is. You know, it's not easy for these conditions to come together. So I'm just enjoying that as I sit here and having mudita for all of us being in this retreat together. And it may be the internal experience may not be wonderful, you know, but still here we are doing the work. And that has a good effect, and we support each other in this. You know, when we're practicing like this, often we can keep going much longer or deeper than if we were alone or in a small group, or coming from our busy lives into a sit. You know, so it's just wonderful to experience these supportive conditions. So the four stages of awakening. You may all be very familiar with them. The first being the stage of stream entry. And then, so one who's realized stream entry, there's a stream entry path and stream entry fruit, which Venerable Ananya will speak a bit more about tomorrow, because there's been some confusion around that in the different texts that have come down. And one who has realized the fruit of stream entry is destined for enlightenment. there's no way that a stream entry will fall back, forget, lose contact with the Dharma completely. There may be moments, and they are unable to take a lower rebirth. So I was speaking last time I spoke a few days ago, I was speaking about this like endless round of rebirths, and you may or may not resonate with that. For me, it's deeply resonant, and always has been actually since quite a young age. And so the stream enterer has seen the Dharma clearly enough to not get caught, not get pulled down into the animal realms, the hungry ghost realms, the hell realms, and is destined for Nibbana. So they may in that very life realize Nibbana, or they may have several more lives. So in the suttas it talks about seven more lifetimes, but numbers in the suttas are a little bit arbitrary. So seven generally means like not many, and 500 means a lot, you know. So it probably means not many. It may not mean exactly seven, but within you know, one isn't just lost endlessly, circling around and around through another birth, seeking another pleasure, another identity, another possibility for fulfillment. So there's the stream enterer has seen the Dharma clearly enough to not do anything that will that will pull them down into these into the lower realms. So there's not only not too long to stay around, but also the life is going to be okay, you know, a human life or a life of it in one of the Deva realms. And the stream enterer, you know, I think when I first lived in the monastery, it was like quite a lot of excitement around stream entry. And I don't know if that's true for you guys too, I don't know. They're like, oh, stream entry, you know, let's go for that. And of course, then we meet all of our huge lifetimes of karma when we're just trying to strive for this this breakthrough. And it can be beneficial to have the sense of that as a goal, and it can be unhelpful. Kind of depends a little bit on the individual. So it can be like that one's so focused on trying to realize stream entry that you are just a self trying to get somewhere, get away from somewhere, and that's, as I was speaking before, then we're just caught again in that endless cycle. But it can also be helpful to put the causes and conditions in place for a ripening to happen. So a very, very important support is to live with good ethics, good sila. You know, without that, we're kind of not going to get very far. And to have good friends who will support us, who will encourage us on the path. So if we're always hanging out with people who are, you know, just want to have fun or get into philosophical conversations which don't really lead anywhere or whatever, then it's not going to support us. So to find, it's okay a little bit of that, but to find find people who understand the importance of this path and practice, and who support you, us, in this path and practice. And, you know, the Buddha says if you find a friend who can support you in this way, you should stay with them, you should stay close to them for a long time. Keep them close to you. Don't just say, oh, thanks, and then I'll do the next thing, but really treasure those people. And I think, you know, honestly, in America, the conditions are remarkably good for this practice. I mean, there are many practitioners, there are many meditation groups, there are many teachers, there are wonderful trainings offered to deepen the practice and deepen the one's understanding and one's meditation practice. And it's not so hard to find people. So I know folks who connect online, you know, in the morning, three or four people will just meet together, do some chanting, and then meditate online together in different places, and then go off to work and do their thing. And it's very, very supportive. So even if you don't have somebody nearby, in this country, there's like a richness of Dharma and of Sangha. So to really make use of that and let it be a support in your path and practice. So the Buddha says many things about the stream entry. This. He says one who has realized stream entry is greater than power over all the world is the realization of stream entry. Greater than the greatest wealth or the greatest treasure is the treasure of stream entry. And when you hear this at first, you think, wow, you know, it must be really, really powerful if it's greater than power over all the world. But it's more that when one realizes stream entry, you realize it's meaningless. Power over all the world is meaningless. It's empty. The world is fluxing. It's changing all the time, you know. and greater than the greatest treasure in the world. I think, wow, must be amazing. But the stream enterer understands everything that arises passes away. Everything's in that state of flux that Venerable Ananya has been pointing to. You know, he's been speaking about momentariness, and then in the commentaries, and then the early teachings, something, there's a beginning, a process, and then an end. So the stream enterer knows that process, knows that beginning, knows that process, knows that end. So even the most beautiful jewels are in process. They're not really what they appear to be. So it's more that the power and the wealth is being able to see things as they are, to be able to see the truth of the way things are directly. So, the stream enterer, the moment of insight for a stream enterer, for the one who has realized the fruit of stream entry, they see for just a few moments. It's like seeing with the eyes of a Buddha, seeing clearly the constant changing nature of things, the flux of things. And sometimes it's spoken about as though, you know, most of the time we have these veils of delusion, veils of ignorance over our, we're looking through these veils, we're not really seeing things as they are. And then for the stream enterer, it's like, it's been ripped, that veil's been ripped away for a few moments, and then you see like, wow. You see directly the flux of everything. And then after a few moments, the veil comes back, because there's still karma to be worked out, it's not done yet. But one has seen clearly the truth of the way things are, so you can never forget that. You can never really go back into believing the stories in the way that one did before. And in realizing stream entry, the first of the Buddha speaks of 10 fetters, 10 things that hold us back. So in realizing the fruit of stream entry, the first 3 fetters have been cut. They're not going to come back. And the fetters are sakkaya ditti, which is literally believing that this body is who and what I am. But it's really, it's pointing to the 5 khandhas. It's pointing to the 5 aggregates, so it's believing that these 5 aggregates are who and what I am. So that's cut. You've seen through that. You know that is not the truth of it. And even though, of course, you know, this, you know, you still move away from painful feeling, and you still want to have nice experiences, and there's still a sense of a person on the path, cultivating the path. There's that, those things can still be there, but there isn't a true deep belief that this process here is who and what I am. It's seen as a process, it's seen for what it is. And then the second of the fetters is vichikicca, or doubt. So doubt in the Buddha, that the Buddha was awakened, was an arahant, fully awakened one. Doubt in the Dharma, that the teaching leads to liberation, and doubt in the Sangha, that there are those who have realized different levels of this awakening. So that is cut on for the stream entra. And then the third one is sila bhatta paramasa, or the belief that following rites, rituals, I like to think techniques, goes in there, will get us enlightened. So it's believing that something external that we do, or that we put onto our life, will bring full awakening. And the Buddha is very clearly pointing to, you know, the 7 factors of awakening. They will bring us realization. They're not some external practice. They're not like if you watch the breath here, or If you bathe in the River Ganges every day, or you know, whatever it might be, or if you bow to your Buddha shrine every morning and reaffirm the precepts, it's a good thing to do, but it's not going to bring you full realization. It's the mindfulness, the investigation, the energy, you know, looking, exploring, looking. That's what leads us to awakening, the seven awakening factors. So those three fetters are cut in the stream mantra. So they're no longer trying to get the right technique. You know, if only I know quite a number of people have said, can we listen to the recordings of Venerable Ananya's meditations, because we want to get it down exactly. You know, we want to, somebody was wanting to get their cell phone so they could get look online and listen to the talk, you know. The teaching is offered, and then we each have to find our way. So, just I think last night Shaila was saying, I hope it's okay for me to say this, Shaila was saying, if at the end of this retreat we have 97 different ways of practicing Anapanasati, we know that the retreat's been successful. So you have to make it yours. You have to make the practice yours. And we're different, you know, different people have different strengths, different skills, different levels of, different amounts of supportive or obstructive karma. You know, we're all different. And one of the things I really appreciate in the Buddha's framework of these stages of awakening is that he points out that some people enter into stream entry, so it's called those who have there are those who are Dhamma followers, and there are those who are faith followers, so Dhamma Nusari and Sadha Nusari. So Venerable Ananya is clearly of the Dhamma leaning. So the Dhamma Nusaris, he may be a little, I don't know. The Dhamma Nusaris are those whose minds love to investigate the Dhamma, explore the Dhamma, apply the Dhamma, and it's through that investigation and through that understanding and application of the teachings that they enter the stream. And then the Sadha Nusaris are the faith followers. And it's said that for the Sadha Nusaris, the practice of mindfulness of impermanence is their access to stream entry. It's kind of simple. It's very doable. So I struggled for a long time with my mind, because I'm very much not a one who my mind is somewhat simple. It doesn't do complexity very well. And for a long time I felt like, oh gosh, you know, I'm kind of, maybe I don't have what it takes, you know, to do this. And it's because I'd be in the monastery with all these. It's kind of an intellectual religion, isn't it, to some degree, Buddhism. So I'd be in the monastery with all these like super brains, and you know, people who loved to study the suttas and the commentaries and the commentaries on the commentaries, and then I'd be like, you know, well, I can watch my breath, and you know, at times feeling quite a little desperate, actually. I'm just like, oh gosh, I can't do it. I'm not the right kind of material. But actually, Suchito very kindly pointed this out to me. He's like, no, there are those who enter through investigation of Dhamma, and there are those who enter through faith. They're different entry points, but they both lead to the same truth. And it doesn't actually say this in the suttas, but it kind of seems to be that for those who enter through investigation of Dhamma, as they progress on the path, the faith gets stronger and stronger. How could it not? You know, if you realize the stages of awakening, of course, the faith is going to be deep. And then for those who enter through faith, understanding of the teaching gets stronger as time goes by. So it may not be immediately there, but as time goes by, there's a natural interest in understanding the Dhamma and applying the Dhamma. And it may not be like brilliant, you know, like. It may be a simple way, but it's still, there's a a deepening. There's a deepening of understanding of the and of the frameworks of the Dharma and how that works and how we can use those to continue letting go. So I really appreciate that that there are these different entry points, and also the Buddha's chief disciples, his male disciples Sariputta and Moggallana, Mahamoggallana, and female disciples Bhikkhuni Kema and Bhikkhuni Upalavana. One of both of those, that one Sariputta and Kema are they're like known for their understanding of Dhamma, so they're good intellect, strong investigation of Dhamma. And Mahamoggallana and Upalavana are known for their psychic abilities. Very different. And they're both, well, all four of them are the chief disciples of the Buddha. It's like, oh, that's kind of nice too. So it's not like we've all got to be a certain way, because I think that sometimes it can feel a bit like that in the Western Dharma scene, that we're all supposed to be a certain way, and we're supposed to be able to understand these intellectual teachings, and we're supposed to be able to do this, that, and the other. And for some people, it just doesn't work like that. So to trust your own way, to trust, to know where do you start, where are you starting from? What is your natural inclination? And to see your strengths and to work from your strengths, and not to think that you should be somebody else and fit into some cookie cutter mold of what you think it should look like, because it looks like all kinds of things. The Buddha's disciples were varied, they had all kinds of different qualities and strengths and skills, some leaning towards asceticism, some very kind of sociable, some some having these psychic abilities, some being able to just hear a tiny little bit of the teaching and then being able to elaborate on it in great detail, all sorts of folks. And the path is, it's for you, it's for us. It's not for somebody else. I mean, it's for everyone. It's not that other people can do it and you can't. So Bhikkhu Bodhi once said that there are only two things you need to realize the path. The first is to start practicing, and the second is not to stop. So I think that we can all do that. We've already started. So the stream entry, once one realizes stream entry, it's a huge shift of paradigm. We're no longer in that endless round of rebirths. And our minds, or one's mind, is inclined towards the Dharma. And also towards sila. So said that a stream enterer is not able to, or is able to break the five precepts, but is not able to conceal that. So if they break any of the precepts, they'll immediately want to just tell somebody, clear that up. So there's no incentive to try and cover things up, hide this and that. That's the self that does that. Or let's hope people think I'm better than I am. Or let's not show them that I do that embarrassing thing. And so for the stream enterer, the sila, the level of sila is stable. And it's also said that the stream enterer dwells at home with a heart of generosity, free from the stain of stinginess. That they're generous, that they love opportunities to be generous, that they look for ways of being able to offer. So whether that's materially or in terms of the teaching or in terms of a listening ear, there's many, many ways we can be generous. So the stream enterer is it's spoken about it as the streams of merit of a stream enterer. The merit of having unshakable faith in the Buddha, unshakable faith in the Dharma, unshakable faith in the Sangha, And then there are two different suttas. One says, and this stable virtue, the sila. And the other says that they dwell with this heart of generosity, looking for opportunities to be generous. So these are the streams of merit of a stream mantra. But it doesn't end there. So the next level of awakening is the Sakadagami, or the once returner. So just as the stream enterer is not coming back, you know, some, not too many more lifetimes, the once returner will only come back one more time. And the once returner has they say, attenuated, so lessened greed and hatred. So seen through the illusions of the sense world enough that they're not going to keep coming back again and again and again. But they're not. But there still is some greed. There still is some aversion. They're not free from that yet. So that's a Sakadagami who is destined for not more than one more birth in this realm. And then the Anagami is completely free from greed and hatred. And the Anagami is the non-returner, will not return to this world as a human being. But they haven't finished the work yet. Still a bit more to do. So they, the Anagami so if somebody realizes Anagami in this as a human being, they will then be reborn in a kind of a deva realm, where they live for, I forget how long it is, but very, 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 very long time. And at the end of that very, very long lifetime in this quite beautiful realm, they become enlightened. So that's not bad. And the Anagami, the non-written, the Brahmaviharas are kind of directly connected with the Anagami. So if one develops the Brahmaviharas, those boundless states, that's like an enormous support for. I don't know whether one can go straight from being not a stream enterer to Anagami through the Brahmaviharas. I don't know. Why don't you try and see? But certainly they say that if one has realized stream entry, then the practice of the Brahmaviharas will take you leaps and bounds. And you can see that the Brahmaviharas, they are directly countering greed and hatred. There's no room for greed and hatred when the Brahmaviharas are cultivated. So that's kind of wonderful. And there's so for the Anagami, they're free from greed, free from hatred, but there's still five more fetters, which I hope I can remember because I didn't bring my little paper with those on. And for the Arahant, those are the first five fetters. For the stream enterer, seeing through personality view, or the identification with the five khandhas, no longer having doubt in the triple gem, not believing some kind of rites or rituals will lead to awakening. And then there's the cutting of greed and the cutting of hatred in the Anagami, which is a pretty big deal. And then the Arahant is refines and lets go of those last five fetters, which are very subtle. So there's attachment to the form realms, which are connected with the four jhanas. Attachment to the formless realms, which are connected with the formless jhanas. Conceit, I am. Restlessness and ignorance. So those are the last five, and we're talking subtle. Subtle levels. So it can be a little confusing because the stream enterer is already seen through, knows that the five aggregates are not who what they are, but you have to wait until you're, you know, close to arahantship before you really let go of the sense of I am. And sometimes they talk about that as like a location, that there's a sense of location, that the mind or the consciousness has a sense of location, and then with the arahant that's liberated. So I can't talk about those things because I don't know anything about that, but I think Venerable Anālya is going to go into a bit more tomorrow about the about Nibbana and so on. But those last five are these very subtle fetters that hold one, keep one attached to a sense of being. So, you know, these stages are, they have been over the years, over the centuries, over the millennia, have been realized by human beings of all shapes and sizes, all types, have realized these stages of awakening. And surprisingly, there are I've heard that there are monks in Sri Lanka who believe that it's not possible anymore to realize those stages of awakening, which to me is kind of baffling. But apparently there are people who believe that's not possible anymore, even though they are Buddhist. But to me that doesn't make any sense, because if this is the fruit of the practice, if the practice leads to awakening, then why would that be so? Why would it be so that that's not possible now? Makes no sense at all. So we need to find that attitude that is open to, interested in, moving towards those stages of awakening, but without grasping. It's that tricky place again. You know, as long as it's grasping, then we're somebody trying to get something, which will get in the way. Oops. And yet if we don't think about it, don't care about it, don't consider it as relevant, then we may just wander around and around forever and ever, doing a little bit of this, a bit of that. So finding that relationship to the path, a sense of confidence that this is possible. It needs effort. It needs putting the right conditions in place. And it needs a kind of a sustained effort and attention to actually break through. But it's not, you know, it is, I was going to say, it's not out of reach. It is the fruit of the practice. So it's kind of tricky, this whole stream entry thing, because people do get very excited. Maybe, you know, maybe somebody has an insight into impermanence and they think, oh, you know, I had this insight into impermanence, so I must be a stream enterer now, you know. But it's a little bit more than that. It's a little bit more powerful than that. And so, you know, there's the trap of believing one has gained realization that one hasn't gained, and then there's the trap of thinking it's so difficult that I won't even try. It's hopeless. I won't even forget it. You know. So there are suttas where it does appear to be like a very difficult to attain state, and there are others where it seems extremely easy. So there's one that I kind of found very kind of endearing, actually. And just made little notes from it, and there's a layman who I think may have been a monk before he and then disrobed, Sarakani, and Sarakani became a drunk and couldn't keep his drinking habit together, and so he was known as this kind of a bit of a wreck, and then at some point he died, and then the monks asked, oh, so what was his destination, Sarakani? You know, that drunk. And the Buddha said, he died a stream enterer. And they were like, what? Him? You know, well, if he can be a stream enterer, then anyone can do it. I mean, this is ridiculous. And the Buddha says, at the end of his life, he recollected the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and his heart was firm in faith for the Triple Gem. So he'd, you know, he knew the Buddha already. He'd encountered the Buddha, and then he'd gone off. He got lost. He'd gone off track, like way off track. But then, right at the end of his life, he remembered again. And even though he'd been a drunk and he'd been, you know, like lost, really, at the end of his life, he remembered. And his heart was aligned with that faith in the Triple Gem. And so the Buddha said, you know, because of that, he died a stream enterer. And then he says this rather remarkable thing. He says to the monks, these monks who were kind of scorning that this guy could be a stream enterer, he said, even if these great sal trees could understand what is well spoken and what is badly spoken, then I would declare these sal trees to be stream enterers. Trees. So how much more then Sarakhani, the Sakyan? Sarakhani undertook the training at his time of death. So it's a little elusive, isn't it? What, you know, you can't quite pin down, so how do you get it? How do you get there? But this confidence in the Triple Gem is a very key part of the path. And then, like I was saying, bringing together the causes and conditions, you know, good friends, retreat settings, times of extensive practice, keeping sila, discussing the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, all of these things support the ripening of this path. So I just want to tell a little story. When I first went to live in the monastery in England, there were two old women there that Ajahn Sumedho had invited to live there in their old age. And one was a laywoman who'd been a scholar and a Dhamma teacher, and the other was quite a kind of radical character who had done all kinds of very interesting things in her life and had developed schizophrenia. So she was in and out of the mental institutions with schizophrenia. And forgive me, those of you who know the story already. And at some point, during the first couple of years that the monks were in London, they didn't yet have a monastery as such, they were in a flat in London opposite a pub, you know, having come from the forest in Thailand. So, a little challenging. And at some point, there wasn't enough dana, there wasn't enough money coming in to pay the bills. So it looked like they were going to have to go back to Thailand and just kind of give up on having, you know, the Ajahn Chah lineage being established in the UK, in the West. And this woman who had schizophrenia, she was then called Beth Tregaskis. She heard about that, and she had a grand piano. So she loved to play the grand piano, but she had rather small fingers, small hands. So she never became a professional. But she had this piano that she loved. It was, you know, her absolutely prized possession. And when she heard that the monks were going to have to go back to Thailand, she sold her grand piano to pay the bills so that they could stay. And so, thanks to her, you know, I've been able to stay as a nun, and many, many, you know, Bayagiris happened, and all of these, many people have had access, and also many of the Dharma books that are available have, in a way, kind of, without her doing that generous act, none of that may have happened. So when she became old and was in and out of institutions, Ajahn Sumedho, without discussing it with the nuns, invited her to come and live with the nuns. And so when I arrived at the monastery, she was there, and she was 89 when I arrived. And she wore white. She was like an eight preceptor. And she was a pretty amazing woman. So she could be very, very crazy, and she could also be very sound. And she had this really, really deep faith in the Triple Gem. It was so deep. And, you know, all around her room were pictures of monks and nuns and shrine. And she was just very one-pointed on the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Very one-pointed. And as she came into her 90s, she started to get very sick. And so the nuns were taking care of her. We were just we didn't call hospice or anything. I think it's not quite such a good system back then in the UK, and so we were just kind of, you know, meeting with the needs of this woman, and she became very, very sick, and we found out at some point that she had colon cancer, and that was obstructing her digestive system. So she was, sorry to go into the details, but she was vomiting this black, horrible, horrible black stuff, you know, that's from somewhere way down in the digestive system. And she was incredibly patient with this. She never complained. She was just very patient, vomiting this horrible stuff and lying down, and we would try and make her comfortable and talk with her. And this went on for quite some weeks. And then at some point she asked one of the nuns who she was very close to, she asked permission to die. Is it all right if I die, you know? And this nun said, yes, it's all right. So she wasn't, you know, telling her to take her own life or anything. She was just saying, it's okay, you can let go now. So she went into a sort of a deeper state, closer to death. And her actual death moment, she was in her bed, surrounded by monks and nuns, who were chanting her two favourite chants. It was the Metta Sutta and the morning chanting, which goes through the teaching on the five aggregates as being impermanent, not-self and dukkha. So, and on the last word of the last chant, she breathed her last breath. So, who knows? She may have died a stream enterer, despite having this really crazy mind, like really crazy at times. She may well have died a stream enterer. So, you know, whatever your particular lot is, it's good enough. Make good use of it. I once had the opportunity to meet Venerable Mahagosananda. There are pictures of him and the Dalai Lama in the bookstore, and they're both bowing and they're both trying to get lower than the other one. And I think the Dalai Lama manages to get a little bit lower than Mahagosananda. He was a Theravada Cambodian monk, and each time I met him, it was life-changing. So the first time was just very short, but it was like, wow. I've never seen anybody like that before. He was radiant, playful, mischievous, kind. There was a sense of complete acceptance. Like the first time I met him, I was an anagarika, a novice, and I was asked to make tea. He just turned up. He used to just kind of get on a plane and turn up somewhere without telling people he was coming. So he just kind of turned up one day at the monastery, and then it's like, oh, you know, can somebody make tea with the special tea set? And so I was the kitchen manager at the time, so I went and got the special bone china tea set out and made this very nice tea and brought it in and felt terribly shy, you know, very kind of like, oh, am I doing something wrong? And there was no table, I didn't know where to put it. And then I felt his mind reach out, and just, it was as though he said, my sister. And I don't think that was, you know, personal. It was just everyone was his sister or his brother. And this beautiful quality. And he was, you know, Cambodian, and, you know, Cambodia went through the most horrendous destruction in the 70s. And during that time, during the Khmer Rouge, he was in a monastery in Thailand practicing, and listening on the news to these terrible atrocities, and he just wanted to go back. He wanted to go home to his country to help people, and his teacher said, don't go, just stay here, keep practicing, and then you'll have something really worth sharing. Then you'll be able to go back and take something really valuable back. So he did that, and he went through terrible anguish, terrible grief, terrible anguish. And then came through that and came out the other side. And when I met him, I can say for certain there was not a trace of greed and not a trace of ill will in him. Not a trace. And he was like this being that is just living from a place of presence and very spontaneous, and loving, compassionate, very bright. He had a very bright mind. And there was just this way of meeting life that was not like anything I'd ever seen before. It was remarkable. And it was as though, like, you know, you could put him, he could have been in a dark room and he would just light the room up with his radiance. Very, very beautiful being. So for me, that's, I don't know whether he was an anagami or an arahant, I don't know, but he certainly was free from those fetters, those obscurations. So it was a great, you know, even though there's a lot of work to do, it's a great incentive or a great encouragement to actually see someone who has actually purified those qualities. And an enormous blessing in the world to have someone who's purified, who's no longer, you know, who's free from greed and hatred and the delusion of self. So we all have this potential, and whatever we start with is where we have to start. And we just do the work, and we keep practicing, we keep exploring, we keep applying the awakening factors, we keep reminding ourselves of the Eightfold Path, because these are the supports for awakening. And it doesn't matter how long it takes, or, you know, whether somebody's doing it quicker than us, or it doesn't matter. We just set your mind in that direction and keep going. And keep exploring. Keep investigating. So I want to share a poem with you from this book that I've mentioned. It's actually unnamed. It doesn't have a name yet, the book. It's not. It's still in progress. But it's by Maddie Weingast, and it's a heart translation of the Terigata, the verses of the awakened, or the early nuns, early Buddhist nuns. And this is Dhammadina's poem. So Dhammadina was foremost in expounding the Dhamma. She was a bhikkhuni, was foremost in expanding the Dhamma, although we've only got one of her teachings, unfortunately, come down. I'm sure she gave many, many. And this is it's an adaptation of her enlightenment poem. For so long, I thought only of the river's end. Then, one day, I put my paddle down to watch the sun rise over the eastern hills. Only to find myself floating somehow, gently upstream. I promise, it was not what I had expected. So we put in the work, and then at some point we let go. I'll try, yeah. Let me see. For so long, I thought only of the river's end. Then, one day, I set my paddle down to watch the sun rise over the eastern hills, only to find myself floating somehow gently upstream. I promise, it was not what I had expected. I'd like to offer that tonight.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.